offering a most loving pranam at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. Joining you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam, this is Prem, and with me is Arvind, and we are here to resume our discussion on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. And the last week around, we were in the middle of a important instruction that Swami was giving to all of us with regards to the study circles. Is one of the disciplines or one of the methods of studying Swami's literature that Swami has given all of us. It's a part and parcel of the activities of samitis and centers around the world. So we were in that position, in that portion where Swami was talking about what it is or how it must be conducted and what must be the protocol that must be followed. And as we all know, there is no hard and fast rule when it comes to Swami, but Swami would always give us the best guidelines to follow. And it is with that in mind that we can carry out any activity in a manner that it benefits most people. We just started it and there are more details to that. We will be going through that. But before we get to that part, there was one question that one of the youngsters who happens to be in that interview or discussion team, who asked Swami a question of how to attain immortality. And to that, I think Swami says that the best way, I think how to attain moksha.
And Swami says removal of immorality.
Right. And Swami says, very often we've heard it from Swami, the quote, the removal of immorality leads to immortality. And Swami gives that as the answer. So we had gone through that in the previous discussion, and one of our listeners sent us a mail that it would be nice if we could dwell a little more on that. How does that work, or what is the inner meaning of that statement that Swami makes? So I thought, we thought before we go into the discussion that we have about the study circle, the rest of the discussion, we'll spend a couple of minutes on this statement, because it definitely is a very deep theme and topic by itself. But probably a couple of minutes in the beginning of today's satsang, we'll spend about what it is when Swami says the removal of immorality leads to immortality.
Yeah, Sai Ram Prem and Sai Ram to all our listeners, offering our humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. It's nice to begin this satsang delving into a very profound and deep question that has been asked by one of the listeners. And here is what both of us have gathered from Swami's discourses. It is nothing that it's like a comprehensive and complete and a sole ultimate answer, but these are thoughts which everybody can add on to, definitely. So when Swami says removal of immorality is the only way to immortality, I think we should focus on the term immorality. What is it that we generally consider as immorality? If we look at our day-to-day life, we call somebody as being immoral if he or she lies, doesn't adhere to the truth, or, you know, is doing things against the law. So being illegal is considered as being immoral. Being unethical is considered as being immoral. And yet, just being illegal and being unethical does not comprehensively cover being immoral, because moral dictates are more to do with one's own conscience. And so it's not just about doing something that's illegal or something that is unethical, because legality changes, laws change. What is illegal in one place, one geographic part of the earth, may not be illegal in another part. So in morality encompasses legality and ethicality both. And it is much more than that. So it is legality, ethicality, plus something more. And I think that something more has got to do with what Swami would refer to as the Arshad Vargas, the six enemies that are present in each one of us, which are Tama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada, Matsarya, meaning desire, anger, lust, attachment, jealousy, and greed. So these are the six enemies that are present in each one of us, and it is these enemies that make us do things which are immoral. And so removal of immorality would obviously refer to the removal of these six enemies. I think, you know, as long as these six enemies exist in us, we are either tamasic or rajasic when we talk of the gunas, the tamas guna, the rajo guna, and the sattva guna. Removal of these six enemies, Kamakrodha Lobha Moha Mada Matsarya, brings us to Sattvaguna or the noble quality. I mean, Sattvaguna is a starting point in our journey to attain God, and that's why probably Swami says that removal of immorality is the only way to immortality. Whatever spiritual sadhana you may do, whatever meditation, bhajan you may do, if you're not able to overcome these six, then you don't reach Sattvaguna, which is the midway point or the starting point in the, I mean, depending on the perspective with which we view it, it's either the midway point or the starting point to reach God. Therefore, I mean, immortality refers to God, and therefore removal of immorality becomes the only way to attain immortality.
Right, and looking at it from this point of view, as I would like to see, there are two things. Whenever you speak about morality, and as you rightly said, when you talk about ethics, when you talk about legality, you're talking about someone else judging you. You know, it's like you're doing something and you're being judged whether it's right or wrong, acceptable or not acceptable. It could be acceptable in one land, not acceptable in another land, as simple as driving is left side in one country and it's right side on the other country. You know, the same thing which is being done in India, if you do it in the US, you're actually breaking the law. So overall, the idea of morality, or as Swami would even refer to it as Sanghaniti, it is about how do you live your life with the least inconvenience to others, at the same time going about acquiring what you want to acquire, or you have the ambition to achieve, whatever it is, and you do not harm others in the process. So really speaking, law is nothing but that. You know, you have a common utility, and how do you utilize it without hurting the other person, or at the same time without hurting your own interest? Right. The simplest example, as I said, is a road. You know, how do different people use it? Some people want to go one way, some people want to come the other way. Some people want to walk, some people want to cycle. So you create laws so that everybody is able to use that without disturbing the other. So when you talk about morality, or when you talk about being legal or ethical, it is only about not wanting to hurt others. You know, that becomes the most important feeling in that. So really speaking, immorality in that sense is, it boils down to the Arshadvargas, as you said. But if you look at it, it is the physical manifestation of the flaws in the mind. I have Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Mada, Matsarya in my mind. How do I know that I have this, or how does another person know that I have this? When I start performing actions which are illegal or immoral or unethical. So that is how people see that I am immoral. So when Swami says removal of immorality, it could very well start from the purification of actions. That are you being, you might have any number of thoughts in your mind. As Swami would say, are you filtering out and ensuring that only the good thoughts get expressed as words and actions? So the removal of immorality starts from actions and words. And it will not stop there, because as Swami would say, that what you commit to action eventually starts becoming your vasana or samskara, as the case may be. And that will eventually purify you, and all of this, as you said right in the beginning, two ways of approaching it. Either you look at it from immorality, or you look at it from the point of immortality. And as Swami would say, even if you become realized, your body will still be mortal. It is not like your body is going to become eternal. It is just that you will associate with something in you which is by nature immortal.
Which is the Atma.
Which is the Atma. Which means the body will perish. When the time comes, the body will perish. But you no more associate yourself with the body, you associate yourself with the Atma. And that is, as you can see, because that is not there, that is the reason why I crave for something which somebody else has, or I want something, I feel I'm not happy if I don't have this, I'm jealous of something. All of that comes because I'm not associating myself with that Atma. And this is, either you work backwards, or if you're able to purify your mind from that point of, you know, who am I? And that is the other way of, in both ways, either way, you will find that immorality is reducing in your life, and that is probably the best way to identify whether you're progressing in this path.
I think that's pretty much what we had to share, dear listeners, that immortality comes you know, immortality, the term itself means that you live forever. And we know nothing lives forever other than the Atma. Because the Atma was there before creation, the Atma will remain even after the Pralaya. It is, and all of us are embodiments of that Atma. That's why Swami would also call us as Divyatma Swarupalaras, embodiment of divine Atma. So that Atma is present in all of us. As long as we identify with that, we will, as Prem said, we will have no scope for any of these Arshad Vargas. I become jealous of somebody else because I feel he or she is having something that I don't have. When I am steeped in the realization that me and that other body are just the same Atma, then where is the question of feeling jealous or envious? Where is the question of being angry? Because when we are steeped in that Atmic consciousness, we are living in a kind of divine solitude. We see nothing other than our own selves all around. As Swami beautifully said during one of the Sai Sannidhi sessions in the Bhajan Hall, mm-hmm. Swami said that all of you are like a being entering a hall of mirrors. And then Swami said, imagine a dog enters a hall of mirrors. It will look all around and think that, oh my God, there are so many dogs waiting to overpower me or challenge me. It looks at all the dogs in all the mirrors as enemies and tries to attack them. And Swami said that when it attacks one of the mirror falls, it breaks into 1,000 pieces and 1,000 new dogs are now there snarling and barking at this dog. And Swami said, dogs behave in the world like that. How does a man behave in the world? A man walks in and realizes that everywhere that he sees, it's just himself. And so, he is lost in admiration. He just admires everything that he sees around. So that I think is the difference between having Atmic consciousness versus body consciousness. We are like a dog when we are steeped in body consciousness. We see things all around us different, and that's why we bark at somebody and we think that somebody else is barking at us. But when we are steeped in that Atmic consciousness, we see only harmony everywhere. We only admire everything that we see. Even by chance, if I see a flaw, what do I do if I see a flaw in the mirror? If I see that hair is not properly set, I use my hand and comb my own hair. That is what Swami pointed out, saying that when you are in that Atmic consciousness, if you see a fault somewhere, immediately you will change yourself. Because there is no inherent fault. What is there in you is what you see all around. And when you become totally immersed in that harmony, everything around also becomes harmonious. And that is the Atmic consciousness, that is immortality. Hope that we have answered you, dear listener. Thank you for the question that helped us also to think and read what Swami had said. And as I said in the beginning, dear listeners, if you have any other points of view and any other points that Swami has made in his discourses, please do definitely share with us. We will try to incorporate it in our satsang in the future. And with that, we will proceed to the conversations with Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, where Swami is now talking to Hislop about how to conduct a study circle.
Right, I think a portion of this we did read last time, but for the sake of continuity, we'll just backtrack a little bit and read the portion which we've covered also. So, Swami's reply to that question that Hislop had asked. Swami says, Hislop asked the question, what is a study circle? It is not just reading books. Study circle means taking a point and each person discussing its meaning to them. Discussing its meaning to them. Like a round table conference. Each person gives his point of view and finally values are derived from this. If people just read, there will be doubts. But if each one gives his view, doubts will be answered. The topic is viewed with a study circle looking at different facets, like a diamond with different facets. There is one facet that is flat, the top facet, and all can be viewed from this. To discover the top facet is the task of the study circle. So this was the portion that we had read, as Swami very clearly says, the whole idea is, and this is so true, you know, even when you are studying for exams, we would often do this, that different people come with their own life experiences, especially when you're talking about Swami's message and what appeals to them, what they're able to relate to, what they've experienced in their own life. That is what would would be driving the point that they will be making when they're discussing about something, and it'll always help when we are able to look at it from that, from the other person's point of view. We get a more comprehensive idea. So Swami says it is not about one person talking and everybody listening. I think it does happen in some study circles like that. But the whole idea of everyone contributing their own thinking to it, and the understanding that no one person has the complete idea, but with others' view, one could understand that point better.
While Swami makes it very clear that a study circle is not about one person speaking and everybody else listening, I think that point we'll come to later, where Swami also makes it clear that it does not mean that everybody sitting there also need to speak. It is not like that. What becomes very clear is anything that is contributed should add to the understanding, should add to the harmony, should add to the peace of the gathering over there. As Swami would say, before you speak, think, is it necessary? Is it true? Is it pleasing? Will it improve upon the silence? You have to think of all these. And so therefore, while it is definitely not advisable that one person keeps speaking and everybody listens, it is also not necessary that everybody speaks. But as I said, we'll come to that later. Swami says, you may take Swami's talks or other scriptures, I think, as the basis for the study circle. Take one point and let everyone think about it, discuss it, and come to the final point where doubts are resolved. If only one person reads, there will be only one meaning. After misunderstandings and different points of view are brought out, the study circle members will get confidence. There is no doubt about this. If only each one reads, this may go on for a year or two, then an allergy to reading develops. Centers must have study circles in this way, and none will note the passage of time. Each one listens eagerly and many will give their point of view. The Bible, the Quran, the Gita, the Swami's books, all of these may be used. What is wanted is a study circle which rotates, giving each one a chance. So Swami is saying that even if you pick up a piece of Sai literature or a book, don't make it a reading. I think in a sense we are doing a study circle here, Prem, because we are taking up a text and we have done it before, whether it's Ram Katha Rasa Vahini or Bhagavata Vahini or the other text, Satyam Shivam Sundaram. We have taken up different texts and we have gone through. Though we have read it out, it's not just restricted to reading, because more than reading out, Swami is keen on the thinking, the mananam that goes on behind that. Of course, in our study circle, in our satsang, it's only two of us speaking because of obvious reasons that the mic is only here and we are the only two in the studio, but we have tried to get in others also. And like our participant who has mailed us, we try to do that because of technological concerns. But otherwise, Swami says that everybody must be thinking about it and must be sharing what they think. This is so true, because many times I myself have seen in my own case, when I read something, I think I have understood it. But when I'm trying to explain the same to somebody else, I see all the, if I can say, holes in my understanding. Suppose I've read something, I'm trying to explain it to a person sitting opposite to me, and when I'm explaining, that is when I get to know what all are missing in my understanding, and I need to refer back. But once I'm able to explain it clearly, it becomes very clear to me as well. That is why also I think, you know, I always used to think during exams, we often have the bright student taking classes for some weaker students. So I used to always think the weaker students are gaining by listening to the bright student. But the bright student is, you know, in a way spending of his time, right? He's doing seva, he's losing. But today I realize that even the bright student gains, because you never are able to understand a concept more clearly than when you are able to explain it to someone else. So in that sense, a study circle even helps those who are apparently at an intellectually higher level. See, one may wonder that, see, all this I know, what can sitting with these people help me? Because I know more than them. No, in the process of even explaining whatever we have understood intellectually, even when you explain that, you benefit. So everybody benefits in a study circle, and that is what Swami highlights here.
Right, and from what Swami is speaking about here, the concept of the study circle and what it is meant to achieve in our time that we spend in the Sai Center doing this is It's very clear. He's saying that nobody really has the comprehensive understanding and you all come together. And as you said, there might be some people who go into a study circle because of their own reading. You know, not everybody is probably interested in reading in that sense. Some people prefer doing bhajans. Some people prefer doing seva. Some people are interested in that research-oriented kind of effort or sadhana. So it might happen that one person might have more to say. But I think the very structure which Swami is giving to it is, you come there with the idea that this is what I want to do. It is not that I want to convey what I know. I come with the idea that there might be something that I can learn from the others. So let me put my point of view, but also be keen and open to the idea that there might be someone who can give. And there are many Chinnakathas which Swami would often say that, you know, you can never discount somebody as being illiterate or lesser knowing, because sometimes you need that simplicity to give you a profound understanding. Many times it happens. You know, one of the most sweetest Chinnakathas which Swami would narrate is, there is this Bhagavatam which is going on in a king's court, and the story of Gajendra Moksham is being narrated. And the king gets a doubt. He says, I have one doubt about the story that you're narrating. Gajendra called out and Lord Vishnu could hear him. How far is Vaikuntha from the place where the episode happened? How quickly did Vishnu come? And nobody has an answer to it. You know, because the king, and you don't know how he's going to respond to it. And so he basically wants to know how far is Vaikuntha from earth, right? That a call could be heard and Vishnu comes. So everybody is quiet, and some people say that, you know, this scripture says it is so many distance away and this many yojanas and all that. The person who is fanning the king, you know, he says, King, can I give an answer? So he says, yes, tell me, what do you know? So he says, see, if Vishnu came running when Gajendra called, so it only means God is only a call away. Right? And actually that's the most profound and sweet answer. Swami would say, see, that wisdom came from a person whose mind is uncluttered, is not cluttered with knowledge sometimes. And how many times we have heard the most profound words coming from a child. Right? So I think the whole idea of the study circle is, you go in, you might be more well-read. It might happen that, you know, you've spent more years with Swami, or you're a Swami student who has heard discourses. It may happen like that, but use the study circle as an opportunity where you go in by saying that, I never know, I might learn from anyone. So let me go in with that humility. Let me give a limited, whatever limited knowledge I have, let me share it with others. But let me be open to receiving from others too.
What you say is very true about the humility part. I think Swami had emphasized it even before while speaking about gurus. He was saying, in fact, I think Swami was emphasizing on a guru conducting a study circle when he said about the guru must accept, you know, you don't know, and we are all traveling together as travelers on the same, towards the same destination. Because even if I think that I have read a lot, I have no idea about the accomplishments or the readings or whatever of the others. So all this is very relative. If I have read two books and I am in a company of people who have read no books, then I am like infinitely more well read than them. But even if I have read 10 books, suppose in that study circle there is a person who has read 20 books, I am not even half his level. I mean, I'm just saying that we have no idea of who is attending, and that's why that humility is always important. Another interesting thought that struck me was, there is this, I don't know if it's a saying or a proverb, it just says that great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, mean minds discuss individuals. So, when we look at a study circle, it's only a discussion of ideas. It's almost like it is meant to make us great. It's meant to make us Mahatmas. It also shows that at times it is possible that we may start discussing events in a study circle. While that is tolerable, we should never ever stoop to the level of discussing people, because that is what mean minds do. It might happen that, you know, I'm back from a Prashanti pilgrimage, and when I'm sitting in the study circle, I just say, hey, you know, by the way, in Prashanti Unlimited was so superb, you know, this was like that, that happened, this happened. Yes, we have gone from discussing an idea to discussing an event. That can also possibly happen, but never should it happen that we discuss people. Because once again, I'll just reiterate that beautiful thing. It says, Great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, mean minds discuss people. So that is another nice thing about a study circle, that from whatever Swami says, it's only for discussing lofty ideas.
Right. And I think the other thing about study circles these days is you have these online study circles. In a way, it is interesting, you know, and the opportunity to be a part of few. You have different people connecting from their homes, and they either dial up or you have a Skype kind of connection. One of the good things is, if suppose one person is speaking, everybody else is muted. So, you know, we're using technology to ensure that one person gets his time of 3 minutes or 4 minutes to convey whatever he's being conveyed instead, I mean, rather than being talked down. So, I mean, I found that as a very, very good use of technology, right? There are people, there are some devotees who do it on every weekend, 7:30 to 8:30 in the night, every weekend, which means you're giving that time, you are coming forward. And, you know, in countries like United States, you have to travel long distances to even go to the Sai Center. So this is a wonderful use of technology and following whatever Swami has done. And they would do this. They would say that we are going to read this chapter of this Vahini, and this is what we'll be discussing about. And you've done your reading before that, and then you come there, you share your thoughts. So in that way, it's one of the beautiful ways by which technology is used to further a wonderful practice that Swami has given us.
That time, there's a scientist visitor, and Hislop records that he is the father of the 16-year-old boy who, you know, earlier Swami had said that removal of immorality is the only way to immortality. All the Swami had advised. I think that is what we had discussed to quite some extent in our last week's satsang. So that boy's father, who is also a scientist, he puts in a statement that is quite bold in my opinion. He says, many fools do not make one wise man. So when Swami is saying that all of you sit together and discuss, he's saying that many fools don't make one wise man. Because just because everybody is participating doesn't mean that it leads to a growth in wisdom or knowledge. Because all of them may be fools. Instead of that, if there's even one wise man, if we can locate him and if he alone speaks, it would be better. I think that is the point he's trying to make to Swami. Swami's reply is so beautiful. I'll possibly read just the first two lines and then later we can take the other half. But Swami says, only those who are intelligent will wish to bother with a study circle. They may be fools in other matters perhaps. But we have here an example of a doctor who does operations, but in bandaging is a fool, relying upon his nurse to do a good job. So, what I liked was the first statement that Swami makes. He says, only those who are intelligent will wish to bother with a study circle. So, whether that person is successful in his career or not, whether he is successful in his relationships or not, that person definitely has a drive, a thirst to know about something. Know about spirituality, know deeper about the meaning of life, and that is why he or she is coming to a study circle. So Swami says the very fact that somebody is interested in a study circle and regularly attends shows that he or she is not foolish in that aspect. In all other aspects, they may be worldly foolish, not worldly wise. They may be, you know, they might have made bad business decisions, they might have made bad relationship decisions, whatever it may be, but by the very fact that they're interested in a study circle and they want to make it a point to attend regularly, Swami says that makes them intelligent in this aspect, and that is enough. So Swami's retort is Swami's retort is, nobody is a fool. You said that a gathering of fools cannot make a wise decision. Nobody is a fool in the matter of spirituality, because all of them have that yearning, and that is possibly the only qualification you can have as a spiritual aspirant.
Exactly. And I'm not too sure what exactly Swami said, whether he said it in English or not. But if you really look at it from the point of view of what you're just saying, one might be a failure in terms of the worldly aspects of life. You're probably not good at business, or probably he's unlettered. That doesn't matter. But what we are talking of as spirituality is when you've taken the step forward saying that the world is not good enough for me, or what the world offers is not good enough for me. Actually, that is what is intelligence, right? When In the spiritual sense, when you say buddhiman, it does not mean that one who is very smart or street smart or anything like that. It means someone who's understood that the world and the happiness that it gives is not good enough and you have to look beyond that. So Swami is saying that only such a person will come to a study circle and that attitude is enough for you to listen to that person. And so beautifully Swami gives the example of a doctor and a nurse. I mean, this is one of the probably a classic example. You would find many doctors, you will find many surgeons who will say that they will not do the last stitching part because there'll be a nurse or a junior doctor who's very good at that. He might be a phenomenal doctor when it comes to the surgery part of it. It always happens. There's somebody who is very excellent at doing that. You know, even in our own workplace, you'll see that. There's somebody who is very good at editing, but somebody else who is very good at photography. You know, and you use everything together, and that's the whole idea. And as I said, it's the attitude with which you go into a study circle. And from Swami's point of view, always it's the difference between the approach that Swami always wanted us to have, the difference which the Sanatan Dharma always speaks of is, don't go by what the mind is. Inside each one there is that Atma which is supposed to be the embodiment of all knowledge. You look at every person as somebody who is highly knowledgeable, who is covered with ignorance, rather than somebody who is ignorant and who is trying to become knowledgeable by reading and gathering knowledge. So that approach itself is supposed to be different. And As you said, it's quite bold to have said this in front of Swami. And Swami is very patiently explaining it to that person.
And Swami goes ahead in his explanation. He says, a man with a dual mind is half blind. Everyone is half blind in some sense. But common sense is necessary in daily life and that is what counts. Each subject is only one road. But mastery, the development of common sense, is a spiritual effort. In a house, an elder is not respected because a younger member has studied some subjects. But common sense requires that the youth's attitude to the elder be respectful. Common sense is required. Humility and love are divine. If you become the master of a subject but develop anger and ego, these are enemies on the spiritual path. Again, you know, Swami is so clearly differentiating between what is the intelligent one, who is the intelligent one who is attending us from a study circle point of view vis-a-vis a normal worldly point of view. Because Swami is saying that as far as I am concerned, you may be a master of a subject, but if you have anger and ego, you are as good as a failure. So these are different qualities that is looked at. And in the beginning, Swami starts by saying a man with a dual mind is half blind, meaning that it was while reading this para for the first time it struck me and I got excited because I thought it was a discovery. Maybe this is what everybody understands of it always. I always used to think, what is the meaning of this? A man with a dual mind is half blind. While reading this, it struck me that possibly dual mind is what is being referred to for Dvaita, the duality. As long as you are influenced by the duality of the world, you'll never have a proper vision. You'll never have that unifying vision. That's why you're always half blind. You're able to see only one half of it if you are having a dual mind. I always used to think dual mind in terms of doubts, in terms of, thinking whether I should do X or Y. I used to consider it like a dilemma, undecided, indecisiveness. That is what is dual mind, I was thinking. It's only while reading this, while having a study circle or satsang with conversation with Satya Sai Baba, that it struck me that dual mind refers to a mind that is not steeped in Advaita and therefore it suffers from pain and enjoys joy. So as long as you're in that Dvaita, in that dual world, you will never be able to have a clear vision. That's what Swami says.
And Swami is referring to the regard that you have for elders and people who are much older to you and more experienced to you, giving them respect and giving their words respect as common sense. I think that's a very interesting way of putting it across. Because you can see this in a more enhanced manner in the modern youth. You know, see, whenever Swami would speak about bookish knowledge, you would say that, you know, it's learning is not enough and you can read books, but that doesn't give you your knowledge. If you look at it, even when we were in school, if you had to read a book or if you had to research on a topic, you had to go and sit in the library and you know, spend hours going through many books. And in that book, where is the portion that you want? Today, everything is so much more easier. You just do a search for that word, and in the whole scriptures, he'll throw you out. Read page number 254, 466, and that's all you read. And really speaking, if you and I prepare for a talk and we say that I'm going to do a talk on this Upanishad or this philosophy, it's so easy for us, right? We think that that is knowledge, right? But when we talk about experience, it's a completely different thing. We do not give value for somebody who has understood something as simple as, you know, as simple as a dual mind is half blind. Somebody who has understood that after going through life experiences and says, oh, this is what Swami means. The value of that knowledge can never be equated to reading
1,000 books.
Yeah, right, 1,000 books or reading from the internet or reading from anything like that. And that is why Swami is saying it's common sense. If an elder says something, when they've done mistakes, when they've fallen in the pit, you know, you have to give value to that word. And it's not even humility. Swami doesn't even put it in the category of lofty ideals. Swami is saying that it's common sense that you have to give value to somebody who is speaking out of experience. And that is why, again, coming back to the study circle, nobody's view is to be belittled. Nobody's view is to be looked down upon. And keep an open ear to everybody. You might learn from everything. I mean, anybody for that matter.
On that note, dear listeners, I think we'll take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, continue with the dialogue between this scientist and Swami. And like this question that he asked, this scientist has some other interesting and quite audacious questions up his sleeve. But all that after this little break.
मंदिर में राजा जिराजा
मन मंदिर में राजा जिराजा
मन मंदिर में राजा जिराजा
मन मंदिर में राजा जिराजा
तुम हो साईं महाराज नर्तन सुंदर
नटराजा
नर्तन सुंदर नटराजा शिव काली प्रिय शिव राजा काली प्रिय शिव राजा
शिव काली प्रिय शिव राजा
तुम हो साईं महाराज मन मंदिर में राजा धीराज
Welcome back, dear listeners. As I said, our scientist is getting ready with his guns trained on Swami, because when Swami says that if you become the master of a subject but develop anger and ego, these are enemies on the spiritual path, the scientist replies that, but it is commonly agreed that science is of great value. You know, it is like he's saying that the knowledge of science is different from what you are saying, Swami, because commonly everyone agrees that science is of great value. Then Swami says, up to a certain level, science helps. It is of service to mankind. But Baba knows that which science does not. Baba is at a level that is beyond the reach of the senses. Not all that he knows can be brought to a lower level. Too much current burns the bulb. Capacities must be known. Swami's power is given according to capacity. Baba is a servant. He waits at the door of the shrine room to give you what you want. Swami's duty is to be the servant of his devotees. There is no place for any ego. When Swami says that there are things that Swami knows and science does not know, the question might arise as to, Swami, why don't you tell that to us? I remember watching a documentary. Forget the name of it. It was a scientific documentary. And they were trying to explain how explaining Einstein's theory of general relativity, especially.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, special relativity is supposed to be easier than general relativity because it's a special case of relativity. But explaining general relativity to a common man would be so difficult. And in that documentary, they compared it to a man trying to explain a mathematical formula to a dog. And they said, how much ever this man loves his dog and puts efforts, he just cannot, because the dog has to raise to his level and his understanding. So I was thinking that is what is possibly the problem God also has when we ask him these questions. Like we love our pet dog, he might be loving us so much. He has the greatest love, ultimate love. And yet, unless we rise to his level or at least somewhere near his level, he cannot communicate that with us. That is the problem that God has, and we think, why are you not telling? Then if that is the case, then tell it. So Swami is saying that not all that he knows can be brought to a lower level. It's like, you know, we use our mind to understand things, whereas a dog lacks the mind. In fact, from a spiritual perspective, that is possibly the only reason why all animals simply evolve. It's like a natural flow, like a flow of a river. I'm from lower forms to higher forms. It's the human's life that is considered so important, because a human being can either evolve and go higher, I mean to the heavenly lokas, the different, I know, different theories, different concepts are there. But you can even go beyond everything, become one with the Atman and achieve liberation or moksha. At the same time, from the human level, you can descend and become a cockroach or a mosquito or a lizard or a deer, whatever. That is because the mind comes into play at the level of the human beings. Because of the mind, man is able to do so many things that other animals cannot. That is the reason why man becomes the crest jewel of all creation. That's why man is ruling the world. Because of the mind. Now imagine a man is unable to explain to a dog what is so simple for him. 2 plus 2 is 4 is so simple for him because he has a mind, but the dog cannot understand. In the same way it is when there is a knowledge that is beyond the mind. If we try to understand it with the mind, we will be as clueless as the dog that is trying to understand mathematics. So, Swami is saying that is what has to be known. Otherwise, just like a powerful current burns out a bulb, that is what will happen. We will all face burnout, but we will not be able to understand.
This is something I think most people don't like to hear. You know, when you want an explanation, somebody tells you that, no, you cannot understand it. You're not there. that's considered a very condescending way of approaching anything. You know, I mean, that's how the whole world works. Whether the person is a 15-year-old, a 20-year-old, you give him the freedom or give her the freedom. You know, you're nobody to decide that. You know, you're not mature enough to handle this, or you're not mature enough to know this truth. No, you should tell everybody everything, right? But it doesn't work that way. The mind needs a certain level of maturity to understand some facts. I mean, even within the whole idea of quantum mechanics and everything, and if somebody comes and gives you only the final outcome of a quantum idea, that no, actually there's no matter, everything is energy. I mean, it makes no sense to me. Because I am living in a world where you throw a brick at me, it hurts. Right? If you tell me that there is no brick, or you know, it's all only waves, or anything like that, which is a conclusion which comes with focusing your mind on that subject, and you know, you have a certain idea of what it is when you say a wave, what it is when you say it's a particle, what is it when you say it's a space. You give the distilled idea of that to me, it makes no sense to me. And in the same manner, you need a certain amount of mental preparation and mental understanding to come to anything. That's one way of looking at it. The other thing is when Swami says, you know, when nobody can take away the utility of science. Nobody can take away the fact that, yes, man's mastery over material has helped in so many ways. But when Swami is talking about spirituality, it's a completely different realm, right? If, let's say, you have mastered a science or mastered a method by which it helps you in your sleep, right? In your dream, you can build something. In your dream, you can acquire something. In your dream, you can become healthy. Spirituality, what Swami is talking about is in the waking state, right? What you have in the dream state has got no relevance in the waking state, right? In that sense, you could have a few $1 million of dream money in your bank account, but when you wake up, it's going to be of no use to you. So Swami is saying that when science is useless, when Swami makes a statement like that, it is like that. The realm in which science operates or what science can give you makes no sense in the realm of the spirit. And that is why Swami is time and again, in a way, putting down the relevance of science. Yes, it is relevant within that phase of existence or space of existence, but not in the space which Swami is talking about.
You know, just to tell the same thing in a different manner, I am reminded of a term that we were taught when we were doing masters in chemistry. It's called leveling effect. You know, so basically, when you are trying to measure which acid is stronger, which acid is weaker, we have multiple acids. We have phosphoric acid, hydrochloric acid, we have sulfuric acid, we have chromic acid, so many, nitric acid. All these acids are there, and you want to see which acid is stronger than the other. So, how it is done is, you take one acid whose strength is known, mm-hmm. and relative to that, you check. You check whether which is stronger, you know. So, you have an acid and the acid has some property. You take another acid and put it along with it. You know, I don't want to go into the chemistry part of, you know, pulling the proton, H+, and all that. But basically, it is able to judge which acid is stronger, whether this is stronger than this. But a problem comes if you take an acid that is stronger than the acid that you have considered. If you take an acid which is stronger than the base acid that you have considered, it is not able to say. It is like a thermometer which can measure up to 100 degrees, you say. If you ask a 100 degrees thermometer to say whether 110 is hotter or 120 is hotter, it will not be able to say, it will just say that both of them are hotter than me. Because they both go beyond 100. But within 100, I can say 60 is more than 50, 80 is more than 70, I can do all that. But once it goes above 100, whether it's 110 or 120 or 130, all are same for me because all of them burst open my mercury. So that is called the leveling effect, where lesser than you, what is lower than you, you are able to neatly place, analyze, put what is higher, what is lower. But once it is something that is higher than you, you have no clue, you are equally clueless about all of them. That is what it is when you say that, when we understand that spirituality is at a realm that is higher than the mind, however hard the mind can try, it just cannot comprehend. It is, it's a kind of a leveling effect that takes place there. The mind gets leveled down and it's unable to do anything. I just thought of this analogy when Swami says that science can reach up to one level. That's why Swami would often compare science to a half circle. And Swami would say it's only spirituality that makes it a complete circle. It is spirituality that completes the circle. And it is not a coincidence, I think, that when we look in the world of science, some of the greatest thinkers and greatest scientists, even though they may not be supposedly spiritual, their statements appear to be statements from Vedanta and philosophical texts of the Sanatana Dharma. Though they may not say that I am a spiritual person, I am a religious person, the kind of statements they make, even in quantum theory, when you look at some of the greatest people in quantum mechanics or quantum physics, look at their statements, you wonder whether that's a statement from science or that's a statement from the Vedanta. Because whether they like it or not, when you start approaching the extreme ends of science, you begin to touch the starting ends of spirituality.
And even as we say this, I think one question probably that might come to our mind is, but aren't we using the same mind to read spirituality right now, right? When we say that spirituality is beyond the mind, all our understanding of spirituality is coming using the same mind. I'm reading the scriptures using the same mind. I'm trying to comprehend what Swami is saying using the same mind. The statement that Swami makes, which he even said when he was here in the studio here, is very helpful. Swami would say that, you know, when you learn something, knowledge, Swami had said that when you use that knowledge to benefit others, or use it in a manner that it is helpful for the society, Swami says you are converting knowledge into skill. And Swami said when you convert knowledge into skill, that will lead to balance, Swami said, inner balance. And from that inner balance, Swami said, you will get insight. So going by that, it is almost like you have knowledge in your mind and you use that knowledge in a certain manner. There is a certain appropriate use for even the knowledge in the mind, even though mind is incapable of comprehending the what is beyond it. There is a certain way by which the knowledge in the mind or the mind can be used to aggregate knowledge and use it. When you do that, when Swami says you will get insight, it is almost like telling that this knowledge is actually deep within, which is beyond the mind, but it probably comes to the mind. It is not the mind is coming to the understanding or mind is grasping that understanding. It is almost like it is deep within, it is always there. It surfaces to the mind and the mind is now able to see. As Swami would say, you know, it is always in front of your eyes, but when you're realized, you say that, oh, it was there, I never saw it all this while. Now I am able to see it. It probably is in that sort of a sense.
Absolutely. If not anything, you know, definitely the knowledge of the Atma or the Brahman is beyond the mind. But as we already saw in the beginning of this satsang, to reach that immortality, the beginning is by removal of immorality. And that is at the level of the mind. So even though we are not definitely going to achieve the ultimate using the minds that we are using now to discuss and have this satsang, this discussion and this satsang will definitely help us in the removal of immorality. And Swami says removal of immorality is 100% necessary for immortality. So it is definitely helping us in preparing for that journey, at least. Going ahead, you know, Swami says a small example. Yeah, Swami ends the previous statement by saying, Swami's duty is to be servant of his devotees. There is no place for any ego. Then he says, a small example. America is not very big on a global map of the world. And California is just a small place in America. Hislop's house is just a dot in California and Hislop himself is not even visible. For a person so small as to be invisible, so temporary in the expanse of the universe, it is shameful to live with ego. Any person with ego is a disgrace. If you expand your idea of yourself to be God, then there is no reason and no place for ego. If you shrink yourself to conform to your relative stature in the vast universe, then also there is no place for ego. The lowest or the highest, it does not matter. It is the middle that has this ego pressure.
It's a very beautiful way of explaining it. And Swami is literally using the science to drive this lesson to that person. I mean, anybody would have an idea of how expansive space is. I mean, I was once seeing a documentary on space, you know, trying to understand how big space is. They say that your mind cannot comprehend, you know, because the mind has never worked with such distances.
Mm.
And there was this wonderful book, which had a very, humorous take on how do you teach science. So they were saying that, do you know that every diagram of the solar system which was ever taught to you in school has got the scale completely wrong? It's a complete lie that was told to you. And he gives a description of how you will really draw a solar system if you were to keep the scales intact. Right? If you say that let 1 centimeter or 1 millimeter on paper can be 1 light year or something like that. And if you appropriately draw the size of the sun and the size of the earth, he said if you draw the size of the sun to a simple penny coin, which you usually, that's the size on any diagram on a textbook, your solar system would have to be 1 kilometer radius.
Oh.
You know, that's the kind of space that we're talking about. And imagine, as Swami is saying, you're in that one country, one city, in that one city, one street. And Swami would say this, even about Puttaparthi. He said, the world is so big, and then you have Andhra Pradesh, and in Andhra Pradesh, you have Anantapur. So Swami would say that, you know, this is not spirituality, this is your science. Today, scientifically, we know that, you know, the edge of the universe is 13 billion light years away or something like that. And to imagine that, you know, that statement that he made, that science has its value. Imagine the value of science in this expansive world. You know, how much more is out there that you have no idea of. Right? So Swami is saying that even if you think of it from your scientific thinking, there should be no ego. Right? So Swami is saying that either you think of it this way or you think of yourself as, you know, when you look at space this way, and then you think of the Upanishadic statement, that Tattvamasi, that you are that which is not this universe, but which created this universe. Or as the Purusha Suttam says, the whole manifest universe is 1/4 of his glory. Right? And when you say Tattvamasi, so Swami says, when you reach that state also, there is no place for ego. When you think of use your own scientific thinking and see how tiny you are, even then there is no space for ego.
You know, it's almost like there might be some people who possibly understand it mathematically. If you say it's 1 million or 1 billion, 1 trillion light years, I know what's a light year, I know what's a billion, I know what's a million. So I think I know what you're talking about, but even to such a person, it would be like, you know, if I don't show you the Himalayas, if you have not seen the Himalayas, the snow-covered mountain peaks, if I scrape out some ice from my refrigerator and say, look at this, and imagine a trillion, trillion times of this, that is what is the Himalayas, maybe you get some sort of an idea, but you know, when you actually go, and I think both of us have done this at least once, stand facing the Himalayas and you have your breath taken away and you feel, oh, okay. And then you come back, though you may try, you know, you're looking at this, no, think, imagine a million, trillion times. No, the only way is you also come and watch the Himalayas, you understand.
Recently, there was this post in social media which went viral. You know, when we say million and billion, we say in the next number we know after million is billion.
Billion.
So we think it's billion, but we don't realize the difference between a million and a billion. So there was this person who said, he took the richest man, one of the richest men in the world today, and he wanted to show what is, give you an idea of how much money he really has. So he measures it in the form of rice.
Hmm.
So he says if you say that 100 grams of rice is equal to $100 or, you know, I think one million, he says. If you say 100 grams is 1 million. So he actually measures out rice and he puts it on a sheet which is spread out to show you the amount of what it is when you say 10 billion. A person has $10 billion. So he actually goes and buys some 10 kgs of rice and, you know, there is that one mound. So he says, this is what you earn in a year and this is what the richest man. To show that, I mean, the idea of that person doing that was to show the divide between the poor and the rich, right? So it gives you a sense of the difference between a million and a billion. When you say a million kilometers and a billion kilometers, it's huge. The mind actually does not comprehend that difference, as you're saying.
And that's why Swami, you know, so that shows why one needs to be humble. Because if you tell me it's a billion light years away, I know what's a light year, I know what's a billion. So if I think that I know, I understand a billion light years, I am horribly mistaken. Because I have no idea what it feels like. It's as foolish as me thinking I know the Himalayas because I saw an ice cube in my refrigerator. So even if I know that much, how much more humble I have to be. And that's why Swami says the only way to overcome that ego is through soham or dasoham. This is another beautiful thing that Swami would often say in his discourses. He would say that we are bound by the chains of our karmas, chains of our own actions. Because all our actions are performed with dehabhimana, which is attachment to the body. And so Swami would say the chains that bind you are of different types. It can be iron chain, it can be a silver chain or a gold chain. But all are chains nevertheless. So also Swami would say, you know, your chains... can be due to tamasic actions or rajasic actions or sattvic actions. All said and done, there are still chains. And how do you get out of those chains? Swami would say, you either have to grow so big that you just burst open the chains and escape from them, or you become so small that the chains simply fall off. And Swami would say, bursting open the chains is the method of soham, where you realize your oneness with everything and you say, I am this, I am everything, you are only everything. And the other is to say that I am nothing. I am nothing and become dasoham. In that sense, nothing becomes everything and everything becomes nothing. So Swami says that either that absolute humility that I am nothing, nothing is in my control, or I am everything, I am the Supreme Lord, everything is in my control. Either way is okay. It's only in middle that you face ego and all the other problems, which is Arshad Vargas, Kamakrodha Lobha Moha, everything, immorality, all that comes in the middle.
And I know the cardinal rule that an analogy should never be stretched beyond its utility, but going with that same analogy of what Swami is saying, in fact, Swami has said it in another way, but using the same analogy, imagine you're trying to overgrow the chain and you get stuck midway. You'll be in more pain. But rather if you go, you know, try to grow smaller, even if you get stuck midway, you'll probably have more comfort.
Absolutely,
in the
yes.
process. Because Swami would say that there is a danger in the process of soham, you know, because you are actually dealing with the same pride. And Swami would often say that, you know, we've gone through that also in one of the sessions, where Swami says there are six types of pride. And the most dangerous pride is the spiritual pride, which you will encounter on the way to this soham really manifesting in its true brilliance. But whereas dasoham, Swami would say that it's always safer. You know, you submit to the Lord and that dependence on the Lord is there, and the Lord is always there to come and cushion your fall if at all it happens. So in that sense, Swami would say, you know,
it's very, very interesting. It shows that better to choose a more comfortable route of dasoham than soham, because soham is, everyone is not cut out possibly for soham. Another statement that is often made in our scriptures that I am reminded of here is Anoraniyan Mahato Mahiyan.
Right.
The Lord is described as Anoraniyan, meaning smaller than the Anu or the atom. He's smaller than the smallest. Mahato Mahiyan, meaning he's larger than the largest. I think another way of interpreting the statement is you can attain God by becoming larger than the largest or smaller than the smallest. Larger than the largest via soham, and smaller than the smallest via dasoham. In the middle, you get stuck, as Swami says. With that, we'll move ahead. Hislop now brings Swami back to what Swami was telling about the study circle. Yes, and Hislop says, from Swami's description of the conversation to be accomplished in a study circle, the circle should be limited to about 10 people. Why? Swami asks. It could be 100 people. And Hislop says, but Swami, not even one point would be able to get around such a big circle. And Swami says, not so. Of the group here, only the scientist and Hislop are asking questions. Not everyone in the study circle will be able to speak. And Hislop says, oh, I see that situation. So, this is what we referred to in the beginning.
Yes, it's again a very important point. Not necessarily everyone must contribute. I think there might be situations where sometimes we feel guilty to speak about, you know, you're talking about waking up early in the morning and do suprabhatam, you might as well keep quiet and listen to the other people who have practiced it and who, you know, are sharing. Sometimes it happens, and Swami is saying that there's nothing wrong, that there's some people who would like to be mere listeners in the whole thing. And the fact that it can be, probably Swami is also giving us the license to call our satsang study circle, even though there are only two people speaking, the number of people who are participating through listening is much more, and even though it might not be in real time, at least at some time they do have an opportunity to contribute their thoughts. So once again, dear listeners, if you have any thoughts about whatever we are saying, feel free to write to us. We probably might not take it up every time in the satsang, but we definitely go through it, and there are many, many times we benefited through it, because as we have always said in our radio programs, we do acknowledge that many of our listeners are way far well-read in Swami's literature compared to us. So we certainly benefit when you share your thoughts and when you share references from Swami's discourses, saying that this is what Swami has said in this particular occasion, and it helps us expand our understanding too. So feel free to write to us anytime that you feel that you'd like to contribute to whatever is being discussed here.
We come back to our scientist now. So now this scientist, he is doing something interesting. He says, Swami, here is this object. I spoke about Swami in Copenhagen, and some scientists who were interested made this object. What is in it cannot be seen. The scientists know, but it cannot be seen. And Swami says, it is Baba's task to transform people's heart. And Hislop here thinks, oh, Swami, you are not getting what he's trying to tell. So Hislop says, Swami, they are trying to subject Baba to a test. And Hislop puts in brackets, parentheses for us. He says, the scientist and his associate had for several years past been trying to get Swami to subject himself to wires and electronic measurement and so on. So I think the scientist here is trying to tell Swami, Swami, here's a box that they have sealed and given me. They know what is in it. None of us know. Can you guess or whatever? I think something like that.
Something like that, is it? Okay.
And Swami says, Baba can transform the scientists, but scientists can transform themselves only by getting into spiritual life. It is only physics in which they are engaged. Philosophy starts where physics ends. Physics is useful, but it is only information. Spiritual life is transformation. You know, in my own humble opinion, I was thinking there are probably many reasons why Swami doesn't allow such kind of scientific curiosity experiments on him. But two reasons that struck me is, one thing is, all of us in our own different ways have done some experiment with Swami. You know, Swami, if you are like this, do this. If you are that, do this. And in our own different ways, we have found answers from Swami. We have found him coming out in flying colors in the test that we subject him to. And yet, having done that, the next time we face another difficulty or problem in life, we start doubting him. We say, Swami, where are you? Why are you doing this to me? In the sense, having been convinced of his divinity, his all-lovingness, his all-knowledge, his all-wisdom, everything, his supremacy, the next time when something doesn't go according the way I am liking it, I start doubting. Which means that it is not conclusive that if Swami subjects himself to a scientific test, the whole world will believe. Because if that was the way, I am sure Swami would have done it. You know, I am thinking, look at Dr. Bhagwantam, for example. He is a scientist. He's an established scientist and he came and he witnessed some miracles that blew him over and he said that Swami is God. His testimony was not enough at all. Most probably for those who don't want to believe, they think that he is a scientist who went cuckoo, cuckoo. Same thing with the case of our first and former director, Professor G. Venkatraman. He has been recognized by the government of India as a great scientist. He has contributed greatly. He has written so many books on science. And he says that Swami is God and he alone can do what no science can ever do. People say that this scientist went mad. So I'm just saying that even one reason is even if Swami subjects him to the test, they will give rise to fresh doubts. People will start doubting the scientist also along with Swami. And the second reason, which is I think the more important reason, is just doing those tests, whether it is reading your mind or materializing something from thin air, that should not be considered as a proof of divinity. It should not be thought that if somebody can replicate mind reading, he or she becomes God. It would be akin to saying Jesus took care of 1,000 sheep. So if somebody takes care of 2,000 sheep, he must also be God. No, Jesus could take care of 1,000 sheep, but that didn't make him divine. In the same way, I think Swami doesn't subject himself to these things because the world should not misunderstand that just doing this makes you divine, because these are siddhis that can also be obtained. And just obtaining siddhis doesn't make you an avatara purusha.
Very true. In fact, technically, if you look at it, I was once reading in Swami's discourse where he speaks about the whole process which is spoken of as how the creation came to be. The five elements are created and, then sattva, rajas, tamas, and the whole process Swami would refer to as panchikritam or something. It is there in some of the Upanishads. The most interesting point is, when you say that first the Lord created Akasha and Vayu and all that, it is not the elements that were created. Actually, it was the ability to hear God, see God, smell God, touch God. It is God who was beyond these ways of knowing Him, allowed Himself to be known in these ways. That was what was first created. It is like, I don't know how better to word that. It is not that the eyes were created. The God could now be seen. Even before the eyes could be created, the ability to be seen has to be created for Him to be seen. Mm. And then the implement to see Him is created. It's almost like that. So it is like He's in a... that is why God is referred to as Aprameya. He is in a state where He can never be known. He chooses to be known. And how can then be that itself be a means of testing Him? Right? When you talk about omnipresence and omnipotence, like if what you said was true, they're holding a box which is locked and asking Swami to guess what is in it. That omniscience is a cloak that Swami has worn over Him so that you can know Him. Because right now my thing is, I can know only what I have seen. I can know only what I have been told. I can know only what I have studied. Right? If I'm able to do something beyond this, then I'm looking at something which is superhuman. Right? That superhumanness is accessible to me because I know humanness. Right? So it can never be, as you said, it can never be a measure of Swami's divinity. And that is probably one of the main reasons why Swami would never subject. And I mean, there is nothing that is good enough. As I was just speaking to an old student the other day. Mm. He said, understanding and not understanding, accepting and not accepting, both is in your mind. And that's the danger. Right? He was saying that the first day he was a Swami student and he was in Trai Vrindavan and he had the opportunity to be close to Swami's Jula. And Swami started asking the various boys, where are you from? And it so happened that the first few boys Swami spoke to were from the school and the primary school. So you know what answer to give, and Swami asked that. And they said, Swami, from your lotus feet. And I think a couple of newcomers also got the clue and they started saying, Swami, from you. And Swami was saying, and this boy was thinking in his mind. He said, if Swami asks me, I'll tell him, I'm coming from Madras. Why all this thing? And he said, I knew it because I came from Balvikas and I know that this is what you have to tell Swami, but I know.
Mm.
He said, but when Swami asks me, I'll tell him I came from Madras. And immediately Swami turns to him and Swami said, where are you from? Okay. He said, Swami, I'm from Madras. And then Swami turns and again starts a conversation. So he said, Swami, I've gone through so many years of Balvikas. I've gone through pre-Sevadal. I've been Sevadal. I've done this. I've done that. Have I gone through all of this so that you will ask me this one question and then turn away. This is not enough for me.
Mm.
And the next moment, Swami turns to him and Swami said, this is not enough for you. Okay, this one question is not enough for you. And it hit him like a, you know, thunderbolt. He said, oh my God, Swami read my mind. And he said the very next moment he thought it must have been a fluke. He said, no, Swami must have just randomly said that. It's not, how do I know that it was related to the thought that I have? So he said, see, both of those were in my mind. The thought that, oh, Swami read my mind, and the thought that, oh, it must have been a lucky coincidence, both are in my mind. So in that sense, what would you use to measure Swami? You know, both of it is in your mind, and the mind understands today and tomorrow it might refuse to use the same thing, same experience, it might denounce and say that, no, it's not good enough for me.
I think that is where, you know, we bring in this concept of Swami being beyond time, you know, in the past, in the present, in the future, because while there are many experiences like this wherein Swami instantly reads and tells something, the reason why we get doubts and think that possibly it was a fluke or it was a shot in the dark that came out well is because there have been many instances where Swami has made statements and told things to us which doesn't make sense at that point in time. You know, I remember one of our former colleagues narrating how Swami had materialized a watch for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then Swami said, oh, the watch is loose on your wrist. So you need to get it repaired and tightened. And Swami gave a 500 rupee note. I think one or two notes, two 500 rupee notes, and said, get it repaired. I mean, first of all, the one who has materialized a watch, can he not, you know, do the repair? Anyway, the point is, this boy thought that I should not use these notes because they have been given by Bhagwan. So he got it repaired, but he paid his own money, you know, in the sense, not the notes that Swami gave. And that evening when he wanted to go for darshan, and he wore the watch also because he wanted to show Swami that, Swami, I have got it rectified, he suddenly noticed that those two 500 rupee notes that Swami had given him had gone missing. And he was wondering, where did those two 500 rupee notes go? He searched everywhere, so much so that by the time he was sitting for darshan, more than the eagerness to show his watch repaired, he was worried as to what happened to these two notes that Swami had given. So when Swami came and said, oh, I see the watch is fitting fine on your wrist, he said, Swami, those two 500 rupee notes are lost, Swami. Then Swami said, no, what happened? He said, Swami, they got lost. Swami said, they are not lost. They are with your wife. And everyone around laughed. He also smiled and he said, wow, okay, yeah, Swami, I mean, you know, at that point in time, he surely would have thought like any of us that Swami is just lighting the mood by saying something casual and jovial. But he says that possibly a decade later when he got married, and when he was discussing with his wife different experiences with Bhagwan, he gets to know that on that same day precisely, his wife was actually stuck in Bangalore because of a band, desperate in need of cash, not having cash, and she says it was a bund, so all ATMs, everything was shut down. Those were not the days when we could transfer via telephone, via our mobile phones. So when she was struggling like that, not knowing how to travel without any money because everything is closed, she says she opens her purse and she found two crisply folded 500 rupee notes, which she has no idea of where it came from. And this is almost 10 to 12 years before they even got married. And here Swami says, they're with your wife. So, you know, it's possibly many such statements. Now, this boy happened to record it, happened to relive it. And when the time came, he understood the significance and he realized what a profound truth Swami had told. Because we don't give that much importance and that much value, we possibly forget to record it even, and it's lost, and we just think Swami made a casual remark, Swami said a casual statement. I remember on one occasion I used to maintain for some time this Prashanti diary.
Mm-hmm.
When I'd written that Swami spent some time speaking casually to the boys, it was pointed out to me that no, don't write it like that. It is appearing so. After that, I have tried to be very careful writing. Swami appeared to be unhappy with it. Swami appeared to be happy with it, because I am no one to say Swami is happy with it or unhappy with it. It's appearing to me like that. That I started becoming careful in that, because it is said that, it was told to me that Swami appears to talk casually. It is not casual. And when we listen to experiences like that, we realize that every sentence is filled with so much of meaning. Because we think like that, that is why we possibly think that, hey, maybe this was just a shot in the dark. As he's speaking casually, he said this also. But it is not like that. And I think that is one challenge for us to remind ourselves every moment who Swami is.
Right. And this conversation doesn't end here because the scientist goes on to ask some questions which leads Swami to give insights into Swami's own personality. And I think that's going to be very interesting. But dear listeners, that we'll have to do next week. So do join us again for the conversation with Bhagwan Sri Satyasai Baba as recorded by Dr. Hislop. As we mentioned earlier, if you have anything to share based on what we were discussing, or like the listener who sent us that question, if you have any questions based on what is being discussed here, we would be happy to take it up. And so you can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. We'll leave you with a bhajan. On the other side of this bhajan, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu for his segment, Love to Love. Happy listening.
सब भक्तों का तू है। प्राण नहीं ओ साईं मेरे नानक येसु महावीर श्री शंकर प्रेमावतारा साई राम
नानक येसु महावीर श्री शंकर प्रेमावतारा साई राम
तुम हो मेरे प्राण हो साई मेरे भगवान
तू है साई भगवान
तू है साई भगवान
तू है साई भगवान
तुम बिन प्राण नहीं ओ साई मेरे